Radio 1500 AM, sponsored by Microsoft and Citrix.
It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and today's show is a rather, I'd say, special show that Fed Talk's bringing our listeners. It's very rare to be able to put a show on with people from the our nation's intelligence community, and so we feel very fortunate to have with us today three people who have spent their careers in and out of government service, involved in the intelligence community, and the topic today is information sharing, information collaboration inside the intelligence community post 9/11 for people in and out of the government. Everybody knows that was a huge topic, a huge issue and concern that came out of sort of the post 9/11 analysis of the intelligence community. So with us today, joining us to talk about intelligence communities, information sharing and collaboration, we have two guests that are going to join us in the first half hour. I have with me in the studio Mark Lowenthal. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
And Mark is an internationally recognized expert on intelligence. He's currently the president and CEO of the Intelligence and Security Academy, and he spent most of his career inside the government in the intelligence community. He's going to share a little bit about that in a moment. We also have with us on the phone, we're very fortunate to have with us today by phone, Richard Wilhelm. Good morning, Richard.
Morning.
And Richard is the executive vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton. And before going to Booz Allen, he spent, I read in his bio, he spent 29 years both in military and civilian positions in the intelligence community. And of course, I'm going to have Richard tell us a little bit about his background. And as I said to our listeners, this is a very rare show to be able to have people from the intelligence community really talking from personal knowledge, their own experiences in the intelligence community on the issue of information sharing. If you have a question or a comment for our listeners, feel free to give us a call. We're toll free. We're at 1-877-936-9333. And you can email your question or comment to us at our email address. We're fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So, Richard, why don't we start with you? You're currently at Booz Allen, but you come from both a military and civilian set of experiences. Tell our listeners a little bit about your background.
Deborah, I spent 27 years in the United States Navy as a naval intelligence officer with a subspecialty in cryptology. I did lots of overseas work. I had a command overseas, a big field station in northern Japan. I was on a float staffs and various ships, and I did a couple of assignments at the National Security Agency. Toward the end of my military career, I was lucky enough to go on Vice President Gore's National Security Staff in the White House, where I handled a range of intelligence issues related to terrorism, cybersecurity, international organized crime, infrastructure protection, and the like. And then I spent a couple of years as the executive director for Intelligence Community Affairs, which ran the community management staff, essentially the forerunner of the DNI staff. Mm-hmm. It was a much different thing then, handling budgetary and policy matters.
And, Richard, I understand that you know our other guest, Mark Lowenthal.
I do know Mark, yes.
And I think it'll become obvious to our listeners how it is you know him. I'm going to have Mark explain a little bit about his background.
Right.
Well, I've spent my entire career as an intelligence analyst. I started at the Congressional Research Service, the Library of Congress. Then I did two tours in the State Department, one in policy and then one in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and ended up as a Deputy Assistant Secretary. And I went back to the Hill and eventually was the Staff Director of the House Intelligence Committee. When that tour ended, I went into the private sector for a couple of years. Then we got attacked on 9/11, and I said, this is silly. I've got to go do something else. And I returned to government service. I was one of George Tenet's deputies. I was the Assistant Director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production. It's a very long title. I was responsible for the overall health, well-being of the analysts across the intelligence community, not just in CIA. I was housed in CIA, but I was responsible for all of the analysts across the community. And one of the things that we built that still exists is the president's priority system, which is still functioning today under this president. We built it for President Bush. And I did that for 3 years and then retired again. I run the Intelligence and Security Academy. We do courses, education, and training mostly for the intelligence community. And I also teach downtown at Hopkins as an adjunct.
So we've been throwing this term around, intelligence community, for people in the community. They just refer to it as the community or the IC. And Richard, why don't you explain to our listeners what makes up, what is the composition of the intelligence community?
The intelligence community is a community of different organizations, some like what we call the Big Five, the Defense Intelligence Agency, NSA, the National Geospatial Agency, the NRO, which launches and operates our spy satellites, and the CIA are fully and wholly their intelligence agencies. And then there are peace parts in other parts of the government. The Defense Department, each of the services has an intelligence component. There's a little component down at Treasury, one at Energy, a large component of the FBI, and all of these together, I think there are now 16, I'm not quite positive, elements of the intelligence community, and those together make up the intelligence community.
And isn't it, Richard, isn't it fair to say that pre-9/11, the orchestration of these 16 components was all done by Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, thus the title? Is that fair to say that's how it
worked? Well, I don't think that's, I don't think that's entirely fair. The director of the CIA and the director of Central Intelligence, that individual wore two hats. And in his DCI role, the director of Central Intelligence role, he ran the intelligence community. Now, some would say that, depending on the director, some directors paid more attention to the wider community than others.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it would be correct to say that the CIA ran the intelligence community. It has always been a component of the community. And, that was one of the arguments for creating the DNI, that the director of Central Intelligence was so preoccupied with running the agency,
right,
that it was his responsibility, that it would have been better to create somebody who focused full-time on running the community.
And Richard, I probably should have phrased the question this way. Isn't it perceived by, average Americans that when the name CIA, that's where it was centralized? But what, as you point out, what came out of the post 9/11 review of the intelligence community was exactly some of that you've sort of summarized the concern that came out, which is it didn't seem like there was a central focal point. Would you agree, Mark?
Well, the problem was that the director of Central Intelligence, and Rich has it absolutely right, was supposed to be running the agency and coordinating the community, but he had no real authority over most of the peace parts because, as Richard pointed out,
right,
most of the community belongs to the Secretary of Defense. Bob Gates today is SecDef. Owns more of the intelligence community than he owned when he was the director of Central Intelligence. He has 75% to 80% of the community, and every Secretary of Defense, including this one, guards that very jealously. So there's this whole part of the intelligence community that the director, either DNI or CIA, DCI, really can't get to without the agreement of the Secretary of Defense, and it's always been that way.
Yeah, now, Mark's absolutely right.
Now, it's different now, of course, post 9/11 with the 2004 legislation, but what about that structure created this belief in our government, in parts of our government, from the outside people looking in, that somehow one of the reasons why we had a 9/11 was, and I know I'm going to get Mark to, I'm going to get the neck, the hairs on his neck raised when I say this, that we failed to connect the dots, because that's really, right, here we go, because that's really, well, that's a large reason, as I understand, for the 2004 legislation was there wasn't a conductor, there wasn't a centralized orchestration of all these 16 agencies, and it led to more problems than just information sharing.
Well, I know we're going to run out of time in just a second here, but connect the dots is the dopiest thing was ever said about U.S. intelligence. We are not in the dots business. Connect the dots is done by four-year-olds. I wish our information came that way. Little numbers, all in order, lots of pictures. We purposely created this large community, as Richard described it, for a lot of good reasons, 17 agencies.
But it was very decentralized.
Oh, but on purpose, for two reasons. We have this belief that every senior policymaker deserves his or her own close-in intelligence support. So Hillary Clinton has it, and Bob Gates has it, and Eric Holder has it, and we did this on purpose so that everybody has somebody in their building to support them. Then how do you go backwards and say, okay, but you're all going to work together? You have two conflicting goals here, and it was never really envisioned that the DCI would direct the community as a whole. He would try and coordinate it and try and make sure they're all pulling in the same direction, make sure that they're resources are complementary, but he never had the authority to direct it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a similar analogy with the National Security Council staff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has the responsibility to coordinate, but short of walking across the West Executive Drive into the West Wing and getting the president to say, I want so and so to do this, the National Security Council, in and of itself, doesn't have the authority to do that.
Right. Now, all this sort of came to a head, all of these concerns sort of came to a head post 9/11 on the reviews. And Richard, I do want to get more in detail on those issues and concerns and how it got restructured, but we do need to take our first commercial break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. GEICO now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. GEICO, the Government Employees Insurance Company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about GEICO's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and I have with me today in my studio Mark Lowenthal, who is an internationally recognized expert. He's also the president and CEO of Intelligence and Security Academy. With us by phone, hopefully still with us, is Richard Wilhelm. He's an executive vice president at Booz Allen. Both of these gentlemen have had a very long career inside and outside the government, in the intelligence community. And Richard, you're still with us, right?
I am.
And before we took our commercial break, we were sort of talking about the structure pre-9/11 of the intelligence community and where the authorities lied for coordination and control and direction of resources, directions of strategies. And it became very clear to people post 9/11, with all of the reviews, that it was compartmentalized. Is that a good way to describe it?
On purpose.
Yeah.
On purpose.
And the reason why we thought that worked pre 9/11, Richard, tell us what was the reason why we kept it that way and we thought it was working?
Well, first of all, I would you know, I would take a little issue about we thought it was working. I mean, we have been working on this issue of information sharing probably for as long as Mark and I have been in the community.
And longer.
I think... I think what's really at play here, I mean, there are some real reasons to keep certain things compartmentalized.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happens in the intelligence community is the normal bureaucratic imperative sort of takes over. And you've got a cultural dynamic where intelligence agencies, to some extent, didn't want to share their information with others for good and bad reasons.
Right.
I mean, you know, and the CIA, sharing information could compromise sources and methods. I mean, that is understandable. But on the other hand, there were bad reasons for not doing it. That is, we want to. Be the first to break with this. Mm-hmm. We don't want to share it with somebody else.
Yeah, turf battles.
These turf battles mm-hmm. occur everywhere, and they occur in the law enforcement community. They occur throughout the government.
They occur in corporate America. I think it's part of the sort of competitive nature of humans yeah. who are in are at work. But it was more than information sharing that they were sort of compartmentalizing. It was authority and resources.
But there
and the
was
power
also,
to
there's a legal issue we have to get to, because in the community that we had structured before we created the DNI, we had a strict, and I mean strict, division between domestic and foreign right. intelligence. And we as citizens did not want that divide breached. One of the problems was that the 19 individuals who flew against us on 9/11 were living in the seam between those two intelligences. They were all here legally. They all had visas, which made them U.S. persons under law, which meant there were certain things you couldn't do about collecting against them. And so one of the things we realized is our legal structure for conducting intelligence doesn't match the threat anymore. And that was part of the problem. But we did this because we don't want the government overlapping foreign and domestic intelligence. We still don't want them doing it, and it's become more difficult in an age of terrorism.
Yeah,
absolutely. But I don't think either Mark or I would say that any of us who were professional intelligence officers thought it was working just fine
no.
before 9/11. I mean, we didn't, and we were constantly trying to create structures and experiment with how do we share information responsibly. Across a lot of divides. I would say that it's been a long, slow mm-hmm. road forward. We're better now than we used to be, but mm-hmm. we've got
absolutely.
Some way to go.
And tell our listeners, Mark, tell our listeners how what we've done to change, to start to bring this change where information's getting shared with people who need to know the sharing this information so that it advances the national interest.
Well, two of the things that we did are actually more cultural than technological, which is probably a good thing. First of all, we went from need to know, which was the world that Richard and I grew up in,
right.
to need to share. And
right.
then under Mike McConnell, who's one of Richard's partners, we went to responsibility to provide. That's very different.
Yeah, I like that.
You have a positive responsibility
like a duty.
To share your intelligence. I will mark you down if you don't. This is a big change.
Yeah, I thought that was in
culturally. The other thing was when we created the DNI, we changed the definition of intelligence. Jim Clapper is the DNI, is in charge of national intelligence, which is defined in law as meaning foreign, domestic, and homeland.
Right.
So he has a breadth of scope that George Tenet, Richard Helms, none of these people had, was they were all in charge of foreign intelligence. Now, that's cultural. Has it changed the way the
and
peace
legal.
Parts... And legal.
And
is
legal.
It, is it changing the way the peace parts are working? There's a joke, how many psychotherapists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to really want to change.
Right.
So part of the issue is teaching the intelligence community to behave differently. And I would say, on the positive side, we've brought in so many young people since 9/11.
Right, they're not wedded to the past culture.
Whose entire lifestyle is to collaborate and share, probably to excess, to share information, but at least they're used to this. So I think we have made some progress. It'll never be perfect. I think it's better than it was.
Yeah, but, Deborah, just sort of look at, the newspapers over the last 10 or 15 years. What official has lost his or her job because of a failure to provide information? It doesn't happen. Now, if you
absolutely
compromise
not.
Information or if you're responsible with it, You know, yes, you do see that. I mean, you know, you still have the system sort of not, you know, culturally attuned and aligned all the way up to back up what Mark is just talking about.
But isn't that part of a function of a bureaucracy? I mean, this bureaucracy, the intelligence community, our government, is huge. And pre-9/11, you know, it was largely unknown to most Americans. It was largely unknown even to the rest of government that wasn't in the intelligence community. It was very quietly on the side doing its thing.
But that's what it's supposed to do.
Right.
It's supposed to do that.
That's right. But post-9/11, there's all this pressure from the public, through the media, through these commission reports, to test if it's working. Are we sharing? Are we connect? You know, it's share to connect the dots to prevent the next, right? Isn't that the whole point?
But the trouble is, all of this unrelenting publicity and scrutiny has actually made it harder for the community to work, not better, because the standard has become now absolute perfection. As soon as the slightest thing goes wrong, there's going to be an article in the Post, you're going to have a radio show, the congressional committee is going to be jumping up and down, and we've forgotten to appreciate how difficult this is. This is an intellectual activity and an operational activity, and neither of those work to the scale of perfection. So I would say we're doing pretty well. First of all, we were never as bad as we were portrayed
exactly to
be. We were never that bad, and we're a lot better now. We've learned a lot since 9/11, is how I would view it.
I mean, based on what I know about the Osama bin Laden operation, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just absolutely amazed in this town that we kept that all under wraps.
Absolutely.
I mean, could you imagine? and my understanding of what I know about it is that there was a lot of cooperation and a lot of information sharing among a very wide group of both military and civilian intelligence professionals throughout the whole community. I mean, you know, when it works well, it works very, very well. Now, how do you take and replicate what happened there or what one might imagine happened there throughout the entire community? That's a very hard. How do you scale this up?
But sure. And I have two comments about that, Richard. One is, and I'd said this to Mark before the show, and having done some work representing folks over at the agency, you know, I sort of know this firsthand from my job. It's like, All of the things that are being disrupted because of good information collection, good sharing, even before 9/11, certainly post 9/11, we don't, as American citizens, we don't know about. So it's very hard to really measure your scorecard because we only know, as Mark points out, we certainly know when something goes wrong.
Yeah, you know the bad thing.
Yeah, we certainly know it when it goes wrong, and of course it would be impossible for the American public and the wider global public not to know about bin Laden. But part of it is just the nature of the secrecy of the work that you have this scorecard, which is largely secret. Mm-hmm. And the other is the bureaucracy. I mean, when you try to turn the federal bureaucracy in any direction, you know, you try to notch it in one direction or other, that it takes a lot of time. It's
exactly.
All these people. It's people. It's technology.
But we're in the middle of this very large generational change in the intelligence community. 50% of the analysts across the entire community have less than 5 years of experience. Now, at one level, that's a very good thing. On the other level, that's a really scary thing. This, I've argued, and my CIA colleagues get angry when I say this because they don't hear it right. This is the least experienced intelligence community that we've had since 1947. Not the least talented, not the least capable, the least experienced.
But Mark, I would also say that this demographic, which is entering the intelligence community or has recently entered the intelligence community, is coming in with a built-in set of collaborative skills that we would die for.
Oh, I agree.
I mean, so I think this problem, as these people become more senior, this problem is to some extent gonna get better and gonna solve itself now. A couple of these people will be captured by the bureaucracy and all those kinds of things. But I think as a general rule, it's going to be very hard to turn that cultural tide back.
I think that's right.
The cultural tide of collaboration.
Yes.
Of collaboration just because of the kids. I mean, you know, I have a 20-year-old at home.
too much information, right?
I just amazed what she puts out there.
Right.
You know? Yeah, we've seen examples of that.
Right.
It's, we all have examples of that. But to some extent, it's a good thing. And you see you see experiments in the intelligence community around the intelligence version of Wikipedia. You see all kinds of things happening that take advantage of the social networking skills that this demographic has.
Yeah, and of course, my closing comment, Richard, to you on that, and I'm curious to see how you react to it is, there's always the pendulum. It's very hard to keep the pendulum right down the middle when you're running something as large as the federal government with all of its interests. And so you have a lot of collaboration, and then you have not intentional leaks, okay, but then you have eventually you have to worry about, well, how are you controlling? I mean, it's, yes, the responsibility to share, but at some point, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of information, and controlling shared information, I think, is always going to be that cultural resistance back to, you know, that idea of need to know.
As you scale up information sharing, there are going to be mistakes, and we have to be able to withstand that. In the greater interest and the greater good. I mean, it's not that people in the intelligence community didn't talk to one another. I mean, Mark and I talk to each other a lot. We trust each other. We know each other, that sort of thing. But what information sharing means is scaling up so that you're sharing information with individuals that maybe you don't know very well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what is the regime you put around that to make that happen?
Mm-hmm. And then to be prepared that you are going to have a mistake, and what can we learn from it?
But you also have to do this smartly. If all you're going to do is flood each other, I'll give you all of my information, you'll give me all of your information, then we can just drown each other.
Right.
So it's not
exactly
just sharing information, it's sharing the right information with the right people. That's hard.
Right.
Given the volume of data that we take in every day, vectoring things, so you get what you need from me and not anything more, and I get what I need from you, that's going to take a lot more work.
Yeah. Listen, Richard, we need to take our mid-show break before they cut me off here. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, it's the Geico Gecko. Now, as a federal employee, you're probably one for a smart presentation, so I've put together some charts and graphs here. There you go. That will help illustrate the money you could save by switching to Geico. First thing you'll notice is that Geico now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. Now, this is big news. But that shouldn't come as any surprise from a car insurance company that has been serving government employees since 1936. And as you can see on this graph here, it's probably why we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. Yeah, no, I do actually realise you can't see these, but trust me, they're rather impressive. Especially the 97% customer satisfaction rate. And when you consider it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more, well, all you GS7 employees or above should just contact Geico. Tell them, Mike.
Hey folks, this is Mike Causey, and the Gecko said it best. Most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above, could get a discount on their car insurance. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and today our show is about information sharing and collaboration across the intelligence community. In the first half hour, we had with us Richard Wilhelm, who's an executive vice president at Booz Allen, but spent 29 years of his career before then, both in military and civilian intelligence and our government. Joining us the first half hour, staying with us in the studio, is Mark Lowenthal. Mark is also an internationally recognized expert on intelligence. He also spent most of his career inside the government in the intelligence community. Mark is currently president and CEO of the Intelligence and Security Academy. And for the second part of our show, we're actually bringing in somebody who's there right now in the government doing this kind of intelligence work. And so we're very pleased and fortunate to have with us today someone from the FBI Intelligence Analyst Association. I believe we have Jason Collins joining us.
Good morning, Deborah. I'm here.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for being on our show. And Jason is the national spokesperson for the FBI Intelligence Analyst Association. And Jason, I understand you know Mark.
I do know Mark. Mark is on our external advisory board that helps us guide our efforts to improve the situation and benefits for FBI analysts within the FBI.
And that's sort of remarkable, isn't it, Mark? Here we are talking, sort of the whole premise or my premise of information sharing is the quantity, the volume, the enormous amount of data that comes in and people who look at it and process it, and yet all three of our guests coincidentally know each other.
Despite the fact that it's a really large community, it's actually a very small community. And it's like being in this really nice fraternity. Everybody knows each other. We know the secret passwords, the knocks, the rings. So, yeah, we all know each other.
So
it's a vast conspiracy. No, it's not.
Great. So, Jason, I hope you were able to listen to the first part of our show.
I have been.
And first of all, will you tell our listeners a little bit about the FBI Intelligence Analyst Association?
Sure. I'm the national spokesperson for the association, and the association is a full-service professional association currently only open and benefiting FBI intelligence analysts, so active employees and retirees of the FBI that were in this intelligence analyst career service or career field. It's very similar to other associations that exist out there. They have conferences and things of that nature to bring up to speed folks on the latest intelligence techniques and issues in the community and issues out in the foreign affairs and things of that nature. But we're primarily focused, as we're a very new organization, on improving the status and professionalization of FBI intelligence analysts.
Okay, so Jason, you listened to the first part of our show. You're part of the younger workforce joining the intelligence community. What do you think of some of the comments and points that Richard and Mark were making about sort of the shift from this need to know to responsibility to provide?
Sure. I mean, I think it was already addressed with the whole scaling issue. Just for a point of reference, the FBI on 9/11 had somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 FBI analysts working across its 56 field offices, its very limited legal attaché presence overseas, and various other bodies that it had to share information locally. Only 1,000 bodies to do the bulk of that work and prevent any attack on the homeland, more of them the defense side. Fast forward today, and we have over 3,100 analysts doing that same work. And it is to meet this need to, this responsibility to warn. We went through those various stages of duty to warn, need to know, and those things still apply, but we're much more proactive today, I would think. There's a push to make sure you're sharing appropriately with not only your community partners, not only those, but your state and local police partners, but also government officials within, that aren't necessarily in a law enforcement or security role, but are in positions where they need to have some information about what's going on as far as threat and other criminal issues and things of that nature that might impact on their world.
So, for most of us, when we hear FBI intelligence analysts, because I think Mark was pointing that out at the beginning of the show, as a democracy, we abhor the idea of our government spying on our own citizens. And that's why there was this legal division between mm-hmm. domestic
right.
and foreign. So, Mark, explain to our listeners how the FBI is involved. The FBI, which is our federal police force, and their territorial boundaries are
right.
within the United States. How are they involved?
Not entirely, but right.
It includes it.
Right.
Whereas for the intelligence agencies, it's extra.
Right.
It's outside the United States.
All right. The FBI, we don't have a national police force in the United States. We are a federal republic. The FBI is the closest thing we have to a national police force, and they have responsibility for preventing or arresting you if you commit certain crimes. You commit espionage, you're going to talk to the FBI. You're not going to talk to the Metropolitan Police of Washington. So their job is to deal with certain crimes that bank robbery, kidnapping, things like that, that tend to cross state boundaries, and that's their major area of purview. The CIA, for example, has no authority to do anything within the United States.
Correct.
The CIA law says they cannot issue subpoenas, they cannot do law enforcement, and so we created this division. But as I said earlier, so now we have this issue like terrorism, which is foreign and domestic at the same time. So there has to be a handoff, for example. So if somebody starts in Paris and we don't pick them up immediately, make sure that he's on this plane, pick him up when he gets to LAX. And so this requires more coordination at a very detailed level of data. That's part of the problem. You know, vetting every passenger list. Think about that. Vetting every ship that's coming into the United States. So we have this huge amount of data, but we sort of understand the lanes in the road. Where we get confused, there's foreign and domestic, we understand that, mm-hmm. and there's homeland. So what's the difference between homeland and domestic? And the answer is yes. Nobody knows. No, I mean, no, it's not defined in the law. One of the interesting vague spots in the law is it doesn't define the distinction between domestic and homeland. So we're still working that out. For example, what is the lane in the road for DHS as an intelligence entity? They have an intelligence and analysis component right up the road from where we are.
And how does that differ from what the analysts are doing at FBI?
We're still working that out. I know that sounds like a horrible thing to say, but we're still working out.
You have to sort of almost wonder whether it's just, you know, something that our bureaucracy is sort of famous for is the layering and the over.
No, this isn't the layering. This is what in the military they call doctrine. Doctrine is why you do what you do. You know, if what you're doing in the Army doesn't add to fighting the enemy, there's going to be a staff sergeant saying, "Sir, what are we doing here?" So one of our problems is we haven't figured out a doctrine for homeland security intelligence analysis other than don't let bad things happen, which is not a compelling doctrine. And so the FBI, DHS, the state and locals, and the tribal, as Jason mentioned, we're all working this out. And once you get to state, local, tribal, these people don't have clearances. They don't want clearances. So now we're dealing with a bunch of people whom we have to keep informed, who've never been inside the community, and have a wholly different way of working and need to work. And I know, you know, people say, well, you've been doing this for 10 years. This is really hard, especially in the structure of a federal republic.
Mm-hmm. So, Jason, tell us, you know, because here we are talking about what really should the role be and what is it that FBI intelligence analysts, you know, and when you think of, you know, the FBI's jurisdiction and its authority, it's inside the United States. Tell us about the job of the intelligence analyst. What has it become post 9/11?
Sure. I mean, largely, you know, pre 9/11, you had intelligence analysts at the FBI supporting. You know, you have this image of the FBI where there's huge, monstrous files that where folks are keeping tabs on, you know, bits of intelligence on terrorist criminals, anybody doing anything that the FBI's purview, which is large. It's the largest investigative purview of any federal law enforcement agency. You know, you just needed analysts there to, you know, be able to run checks on, you know, databases and things of that nature. Now you have intelligence analysts at the FBI. Now that you have that larger body of analysts and you've had this change, you've had the Intelligence Reform and Prevention of Terrorism Act, or Terrorism Prevention Act, you've had some definition given to what the FBI should be doing with its intelligence analysts. So they've brought in a...
And what is that, Jason? Tell us, sure. What is this, the 2004 legislation, how has it changed what FBI intelligence gathering and analysis, how's it changed the function?
Sure. The purpose that the Intelligence Reform and Prevention of Terrorism Act wanted the Bureau to do was have an intelligence-driven intelligence and law enforcement agency. And so what that means is having intelligence analysts intimately involved in the planning and aspects of deciding what targets to go after, what the threat is, and basically making sure that that information gets to the appropriate customers. So while we were talking earlier in the show, you know, the director of the FBI obviously needs his own intelligence staff to keep him informed and his senior executives informed, and that's a large part of what those analysts are doing. They're doing FBI-centric needs and making sure the FBI's needs are met for intelligence and getting that information shared within the Bureau, but also playing its larger part of providing that intelligence to the community and providing it to state and local partners. So those analysts were brought on board to do that, and that's one of the things that we're most interested in, making sure that we're taking ownership of the intelligence mission of the FBI and getting that intelligence-driven nature to be the culture of the FBI.
So it's sort of dancing around the real question, because for people, for Americans who remember McCarthyism and some of the this sort of the 60s, you know, in the 60s, mm-hmm. some of the social concerns and political concerns, they felt that the FBI was spying.
Well, the FBI was spying.
They were spying on their own citizens for political reasons. What is it? And which is largely why, as Mark explained, this legal division went up, and which is why the FBI really didn't have a very strong, it had problems really figuring out pre-9/11 what its real role was domestically in the intelligence world. So what can you tell our listeners, Jason, when you say your intelligence gathering, about what? What are you looking at?
I mean, Mark has it absolutely right. We're a constitutional republic, and with that, it carries all the same sort of restrictions that, you know, people think about their rights and laws and things that protect them, and the FBI has to operate within that environment. And that's something that when we're looking at individuals overseas, you know, in the CIA's role, we don't have that sort of issue that we have to worry about people's protections and rights. But no organization in the U.S. government probably gets more training and more focus on you need to know what the rights and laws of individuals that potentially could be doing bad things in the United States that we do need to get to the bottom of, but we also have to respect their rights and do it the proper way. Now, the problem with this, and I think that you can probably figure this out, is humans watching humans, you always are going to have a human element, because people have just as much problem with the technical, you know, when you have these filtering systems that people are always talking about. You know, computers make mistakes, humans make mistakes as well, but no other agency is going to have the same level of detail and attention given towards respecting, you know, privacy and using the least intrusive methods to determine whether or not an individual is actually a threat to the United States and its people.
Okay, listen, Jason, hang on there, and because we have to take a commercial break, we want to follow up with you after our commercial break. You are listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. Geico, the government employees insurance company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and today's show was about the information sharing and collaboration inside the intelligence community. With me right now in the studio is Mark Lowenthal. I've introduced Mark before. He has spent his entire career in the intelligence side of the intelligence analyst side of the intelligence community. We have with us by phone Jason Collins. He's an FBI intelligence analyst, and he's also the national spokesperson for the FBI Intelligence Analyst Association. Jason, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
So, Jason, my takeaway before the break was that your the employees in your job category, the intelligence analyst inside the FBI, post 9/11, you're looking at information about people inside the United States who might be up to something. You know, some sort of illegal activity. And I know Mark hates this expression, but I don't have a better one. I don't have a better one up my sleeve. But aren't you also sort of part of the transition of information that connect the dot? You know, information that's gathered. He hates it. Information that's gathered abroad by the CIA, if it involves something that's or persons moving something or, you know, into the United States, aren't you the people who are, isn't that the handoff?
Well, definitely. The FBI is part of that handoff, and it's not the only part now. I mean, you've got some things that were created. I'm actually the senior FBI supervisor over the analysts from the FBI that are detailed to the National Counterterrorism Center, which was, of course, set up by the Intelligence Reform Act. So you've got that. You know, that's an organization that has both responsibility for tracking threats overseas and watching them and seeing if they are a potential threat that's going to transition to the homeland, and still has action and responsibility for a analysis of that data to get the threat warning out. But you, what you have with the FBI is the FBI, because it has, you know, we're not the only people at the FBI doing this sort of activity. We are partners with intelligence, you know, intelligence analysts are partners with FBI agents, who are sworn law enforcement officers who get training in how to deal with individuals that may be potential threats, but might also be U.S. citizens and entitled to protection. So you may have a center like NCTC that's set up to analyze everything, a threat that gets emanated from a CIA source overseas, and then that person tries to come into the United States. If they do get in the United States and they're in the United States, the FBI is going to be the organization that needs to take action against that person when it's determined that it's time to stop that individual from their threat. So you have that transition period, and it's in centers like NCTC that do the analysis, and everybody's trying to do that analysis of where that threat is. But the actual action arm of the U.S. government for making arrests, almost often than not, is going to be the FBI. So our FBI analysts have to be doing their homework to make sure that they're following threats that the CIA is following, that the NCTC is putting out analysis on, and stay up to speed, and doing all the work that they need to do just for the FBI to continue its data gathering and sorting through those threats. So all that's going on at the same time while trying to make sure that no one who doesn't need to be investigated is being investigated, and as soon as we determine that they're not, we don't investigate them anymore. That's sort of where that's the challenge that FBI analysts face when they're partnering with their partners, the FBI agent.
And the last point that Jason made is really important. You know, the FBI or the National Security Agency are not happily opening files on every American who comes across their path. There are these very strict rules. NSA is probably even more uptight about it in a good sense than the FBI is. First of all, they know it's against the law. And second of all, they don't have the time for this. They have enough on their plate with the things they know they've got to worry about than to say, hey, let's investigate these guys. This will be fun. It's just, I realize there are a lot of people out there who are worried about these vast dark conspiracies. They're not there. It's okay. And the rules are fairly severe.
Well, it's just an enormous task, as I think Jason explains. When you talk about these centers or the centers.
The NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center.
Yeah.
Which belongs to the DNI, by the way.
Right. And I was going to make that point that these centers are post-9/11 creations of the 2004 legislation.
Well, let's give credit here. The first idea for centers was Bob Gates when he was director of Central Intelligence in the Bush 41 administration. Now, they were smaller and more varied, but he was the first guy who said, we need to have centers where we bring analysts, operators,
and
from other agencies together.
And they were very small centers. Now, it's legislated,
right,
and it's overseen by someone with authority and control and who can direct, and there's obviously an enormous amount of resources, mm-hmm, which was another pre-9/11 issue, money, people, bodies, you know, technology. And so I'm sort of curious, Mark, of your opinion of how well these centers are working. And, of course, Jason, you know I'm going to want to hear from the FBI intelligence analyst point of view how you think it's working, because from the outside, I think the fact, you know, Richard points this out, since we haven't heard of a big screw-up or mistake, it means it must be working.
Of course. No news is no news. I think the centers were a really good idea. I think the idea of bringing analysts and operators together, I think the idea of bringing lots of people together from different parts of the community, excuse me, to get over this, you know, all these different agencies working individually, it was a fabulous success. And so the NCTC is building on this. As I said, Bob Gates was the one who came up with it. The problem with the centers tends to be an intellectual problem. The centers focus on things. We worry about, there's a counterterrorism center, there's a counter-narcotics center, there's a counterintelligence center, and the issue then is to lash up those people with people who know the regions, because to quote Jim Clapper, everything happens someplace. And so you need to make sure that when you're dealing with the counterterrorism center and they're worried about the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, have you talked to a Yemeni analyst who can explain to you the tribal culture of Yemen? Because this isn't happening in a vacuum. So I think that tends to be the problem. But overall,
the problem being that you don't think they're having the right talent?
We don't have enough conversation between the functional analyst, as we call them, the person worrying about terrorism and narcotics, and the regional analyst.
Got it.
But I think overall, the centers have proven to be successful in getting us into this information sharing that we all value.
Jason.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mark's issue with the analysts always communicating with regional analysts, and that's essentially it's a divide that we've always had, where, you know, folks that are very in tune with the governments, the players, and the regions and the people, you know, focus on the regions, the government, and the people, and political events and things of that nature. And then we had this need when we started having terrorism pop up as a serious issue in the 60s and 70s. Folks started to see the need towards specialization, and then in the 80s we got towards the Counterterrorism Center at CIA. Now you have this National Counterterrorism Center, and it's still essentially folks are only singularly focused on counterterrorism, so they learn that as a discipline, and they are primarily interested in the terrorist groups and actors and how they involve themselves against the governments or whatever, where they come from, but they don't have that same focus as the regional analysts. So those folks are talking, you know, it's always a, you know, who knows the region better, who knows the player better, you know, is it a terrorist actor that, you know, getting to the bottom of that threat, that's always going to be a challenge. What the NCTC does that I think is the best, and I think that, you know, there's always a question about how large the DNI should be, what should be the purpose, what should its focus be. There are things that I think you need to do at a community level that just cannot be done in a singular agency well, and that is, you know, the total bottom line threat that gets to the president on terrorism, let's say, for an instance, I think should come from an area where agencies have to send people, some of its best and brightest from every agency, where they can all see each other's intelligence information and make an actual judgment on what is going on in the threat. And that's what NCTC offers the promise of. It definitely happens. There are always these turf issue battles, but nowhere else in the government is there a place where an FBI analyst can see the most restricted CIA intelligence information on an activity that's going on overseas, but they can because they're at a DNI center that is responsible for tracking the threats both externally and in the homeland. So,
and of course, Jason, pre 9/11, the FBI intelligence analysts arm of the FBI, I don't want to say they were cut out, but there was a perception that you had to get invited in, and it was always hard to acquire information because you were the domestic guys. Do you see that culture changing? You're sitting in the centers. Do you see that changing?
No, I mean, it has to change. It's something that has been legislated. It's something that, you know, when TTIC, the first iteration of this center, stood up, you know, obviously it was a very revolutionary idea that you would have a place where that would happen. There was information sharing already being done between, let's say, the CIA and the FBI. You had FBI agents at CIA, but it was considered ad hoc. It was ad hoc or very limited information sharing at that time. So it's far vastly expanded. You know, we have FBI analysts here that see very, very restricted information that only a handful of CIA analysts would see, but it's due to their role here and their value added that they bring as an FBI analyst, knowing what's going on at FBI, knowing the FBI systems and things of that nature. They're able to bring that together with a DIA analyst or a Coast Guard analyst or a State Department INR analyst. All those folks are here, and they're actually, you know, working in disparate teams where they are a DNI employee for better or not, working together. They're not an FBI analyst who is a rep. They are an analyst that's an FBI background, but bringing their mindset towards a DNI sort of focused problem. So I think that's a little bit more unique and definitely is the next evolution. Are there challenges? You know, everybody has a sensitive operation that they're concerned about where, you know, if another agency, and it may be very legitimate, you know, an individual that we are working against could be an employee of another government agency, and you just don't want that individual, if they are a threat, to get a heads up that they're being investigated.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's always going to be a challenge between operators and intelligence analysts.
And you were listening to me in the first half of my show.
Sure.
So listen, Jason, I have 1 minute left. I need Mark to comment on whether in 45 seconds you got to tell me what you think is the next iteration or evolution of these centers.
Well, I think the main issue now is making sure that the agencies send their best people to the centers. And we have an incentive for doing that in the community. When Mike McConnell was the director, he said, just like in the military, you're not going to get flag rank unless you do joint duty. In the intelligence community, you're not going to get the equivalent of flag rank unless you do joint duty. So I think continuing to forge this integrated community, which is what Clapper is working on, is the next goal.
Okay, that's the final word. Jason Collins of the FBI Intelligence Analyst Association, thank you so much for joining us. And Mark Lowenthal, it was very nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
And we look forward to our show next year where we catch up with the both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.